Hello, this is Michael Olson, Director of Development for Stand Up for Kids Orange County and the host of Listen Up, the Stand Up for Kids podcast. On today's episode, we'll be speaking with Dr. Nishant Kumar, a physician at Kaiser Permanente and an advisory board member for Stand Up for Kids Orange County. We're going to talk to him about his work as a psychiatrist working with clients on mental health and addiction issues. Welcome, Dr. Kumar.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me. Appreciate the time.
All right. So what is it that you do for work?
So my role, Mike, is I'm an addiction psychiatrist. I'm actually boarded in psychiatry, addiction psychiatry, and addiction medicine. So a lot of the work that I do covers, you know, treating adults with general psychiatric issues from depression, anxiety disorders, mood disorders, ADHD, bipolar disorder, and psychotic disorders like schizophrenia. So mostly, you know, 18 and above when it comes to general psychiatric issues, but then because I also wear another hat that covers sort of addiction psychiatry and addiction medicine, I work with a population who struggles with any sort of substance use disorder or even a behavioral addiction. So whether that's alcohol or drugs or even other behavioral addictions such as gambling or sex or pornography. So I work with a population that struggles with any sort of addiction or substance use disorder. And that could be actually adolescents, you know, down to 12 years old, 13 years old, and also into adults as well. So that's kind of what my role is as a clinician.
And what is the, like, what percentage of people fall into the category of people that you support? Like, are you on the very fringe of like mental health issues, or can you kind of get into that a little?
Yeah, so I mean, I deal with a lot of very acute patients. You know, I don't work in an inpatient setting, a hospital setting. But, you know, a lot of our mental health care is actually provided on the front end by our general practitioners and family practice doctors. But usually when it becomes sort of more difficult, more challenging, more acute, then they'll refer to psychiatrists, you know, who are considered sort of specialists, just like other areas in medicine. So usually by the time that they're coming to see me or any psychiatrist, they're really having complicated anxiety or depression or other mood or psychotic symptoms that warrants a psychiatrist, a specialist to sort of get involved to help manage their symptoms, get them feeling better, get them stable, and get them back to their quality of life. When it comes to addiction, you know, unfortunately, there isn't a lot of education and training provided to physicians across the board when it comes to treating and managing either behavioral addictions or substance use disorders. So usually if there's any concern about that, then they go directly to an addiction medicine physician or an addiction psychiatrist. And again, we'll help them as far as whether it's detox needs, rehabilitation, outpatient treatment, additional support, you know, through therapy and also through medications and support groups as well.
Okay. And you said addiction, there's not a lot of, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but education or expertise in that on the front line, is that what you mean?
Yeah. So, you know, as you go through medical school and training and as you go through residency and fellowship, depending on the specialty you choose, you know, all specialties will usually have some sort of exposure and training when it comes to general medicine or emergency medicine. But as you get further along in your career, you know, you really sort of focus on your specialty. But with addiction medicine, it's not a large component of the didactics in medical school or even for during the medical internship year. So it becomes very challenging to sort of know how to manage and how to best support and treat people dealing with any sort of substance use disorder. So usually that's not managed by general practitioners or internal medicine doctors. It's usually sent directly to an addiction medicine, you know, specialist to kind of help them because it can be quite complicated, not just from a medical standpoint, but also from the therapeutic standpoint and understanding all the different modalities that are involved in helping that person kind of get better and get stable.
So is that a, is that something that is like a, is that a, is that a problem in the educational, are they missing?
You know, it's something that's the medical community and even the medical education system is definitely looking into as far as increasing the amount of exposure and training that's provided to all physicians, regardless of specialty. But I think we'll always see that those struggling and fall into this sort of category of having a substance use disorder really only getting treated by the specialist. But I think what would be helpful if there's more education and training involved is be able to pick up, you know, that somebody is actually struggling with a substance use disorder so that we can get them referred to the appropriate clinician and engaged in treatment sooner. So there's been a lot of assessments and scales and a lot of education to family practitioners and other specialists to sort of ask basic questions about consumption of alcohol, use of drugs, frequency and amount, so that it sort of gives us some sort of gauge and some objective measures, and then immediately refer them to the specialist that they need to see.
Okay. And again, so you're in the psychiatry field and substance abuse addiction area. Is it mostly addiction affiliated at the where what you're doing right now?
So I went through kind of different phases in my career, you know. So my path was, after medical school, I did a general residency in psychiatry. And then after that, you can, you know, continue education and pick a fellowship that allows you to subspecialize. And that could be from geriatric psychiatry, forensic psychiatry, child and adolescent psychiatry. And I chose addiction psychiatry as an additional training year fellowship. And then I, from there, I kind of went on to do private practice, where I was working with just general adults struggling with, you know, just general psychiatric issues, but also, you know, using my addiction training to kind of help patients that are struggling with any sort of substance use disorder. And then I kind of shifted gears from private practice to becoming a consultant and working really on site for multiple drug and alcohol rehabilitation programs here in Orange County. And I was providing services. And really my focus there was more as an addiction psychiatrist, but, you know, as we know, that you can't really separate the two. You know, majority of those that are struggling with some sort of substance use disorder, usually there is some sort of underlying psychiatric issue, and whether that's trauma, depression, untreated bipolar, anxiety, that sort of drives them to sort of maybe seek out substances to either get immediate relief, self-medicate to some degree. So you're really always incorporating some sort of psychiatric treatment and care in anyone you're working with that's struggling with a substance use disorder. And then after I did the consulting work for, you know, a few years, then I joined up with Southern California Permanente Medical Group, where now I would say about 60% of the work that I do is general psychiatry. So those that really aren't struggling with any substance use disorder, and that's the adult population that I work with. But then I also work and wear a different hat as far as under the addiction medicine department, where I'm working with those that are struggling with really a primary substance use disorder. And then with that can come treating, you know, their psychiatric issues as well. So I would say about 60% of the work that I do is really just straight psychiatry, and 40%, you know, involves substance use disorder with or without the psychiatric component, or what's referred to as sort of the kind of dual diagnosis patients.
Okay. And so back in your fellowship time, you had a choice to make as far as taking a fellowship, I think, is one of the choices. And then if I do that, which one am I going to take?
Yeah.
What was your reasoning behind going down the addiction path?
I get asked this quite a bit, because as I was going through my training, I actually was leaning more towards forensic psychiatry. You know, I just found it interesting. It was a nice complement to medicine. Kind of looking at the legal aspect of cases, being in the courtroom was kind of exciting and something different than working in a hospital or a clinic, but still using my medical degree and training. But I started to really see the growing need and the challenge that this population faced in, one, getting adequate care, receiving treatment, and then the sort of the stigma around this population, how in a lot of clinicians kind of, because either of lack of knowledge or experience or training, kind of move away and shy away with kind of engaging with this population. And so I started working with these patients at a really powerful mentor at Cedars-Sinai, where I did my training and fellowship. And he kind of took me under his wing and kind of educated me. I started reading a lot more about treating substance use disorders. And I started see a lot of these patients improve. I started to see them get their quality of life back, you know, maintain sobriety, stay out of the legal system, their health improve, you know, get their families rebuilt. And I really started to see that, wow, this is a population that is very challenging, but I feel like I can help them and I can support them. And with the right further education, you know, I could sort of continue this work in my career without having to necessarily give up the psychiatric part, which I'm passionate about as well. So I was offered the fellowship position at Cedars-Sinai and decided to pursue that. And then since then, I've had no regrets and I continue to kind of really enjoy this work.
Okay. So now I want to get a little more ground level on what it's like to work with patients. And I guess the first question would be, what's your day-to-day like? How many clients do you see? Do you have a really diverse population over the course of a single day?
Absolutely. I would say in my current sort of work that I'm doing right now, it is in an outpatient setting. So it's not in a hospital, it's not in a rehab program or a detox facility, but it is an outpatient setting. So patients are coming in really for an assessment or for ongoing management and treatment and stabilization, again, either for their psychiatric issues or for their substance use disorders. And so typically in a day, I can see anywhere between maybe 9 and 11 patients. And that's a combination of new patients or follow-up patients. And then, you know, because of the medical group that I work with, you know, we treat a diverse population, you know, socioeconomically, from ethnicities, you know, genders, age groups, you know, we treat a really diverse population just because the medical plan, you know, provides coverage to a variety of employers, and, you know, Medi-Cal patients and those that who wish to, you know, obtain the insurance through their own, covered California. So yeah, we treat sort of a variety of patients. So it could, that day could consist of, you know, a 13-year-old struggling with a substance use disorder, or, you know, a 75-year-old or 80-year-old patient with dementia and behavioral issues, or somebody in college who's really finding out that they have ADHD and they need to be assessed and treated. So it's a good mix, and it's a variety. So the day is never boring. It's always quite exciting and challenging. But yeah, it could be a variety of patients, and it's going to be a combination of either just psychiatry or an addiction component to it.
Gotcha. Yeah, and I had a tech support job that was like that, where like everything but the kitchen sink thrown at you, and you never know what the day holds, and it's not quite the same in your situation. But I can empathize a little bit. Yeah. So I imagine that's pretty challenging from the different demographics. There are cultural differences, age at different ages, people have different life experiences. How do you deal with that?
You know, I think fortunately, because I did a lot of I grew up in Southern California, and I did a lot of all my education and training here, that, you know, Southern California is very diverse, you know, socioeconomically, culturally, you know, gender wise. So I think having that exposure all throughout my training sort of made me aware of kind of understanding the similarities, but also the differences, you know, between these different age groups, genders and ethnicities and socioeconomic, you know, classes. So I've worked all across the board, you know, with a diverse population. So I think just having that awareness and understanding that, look, everyone has different experiences in their life that are going to shape who they are, you know, and some can be strengths, you know, and benefits that allows them to sort of overcome certain things. And a lot of people, unfortunately, they have very, you know, some very difficult situations and challenges or traumas. And learning to kind of just give that person that space to be able to share their life story and trust you, you know, to share that life story, and then to be able to take away from their experience and hear them out, and then understand how best to kind of help them. Because, you know, not one day goes by where do I hear the same thing over and over. I mean, it can be the same diagnosis, but the makeup of the person is very, very different. And how they sort of ended up in my office, everyone's trajectory is very, very different. So I just kind of have to just stop and just really listen and kind of appreciate and respect their time and their willingness to kind of share their life story with me, and then to see what role I can play to kind of help them.
Yeah. And are the people that, that you see, are they there, voluntarily, or is it all voluntary in your situation?
Yeah, it has to be voluntary. You know, I mean, it's an outpatient setting. It's voluntary, but in the sense that, you know, they're not court mandated necessarily, to have to enter treatment. Although some, you know, patients can have legal issues where they're required to meet with their psychiatrist or be on medications and get progress reports or letters from their psychiatrist to say that they are actively participating in treatment. But in a general sense, yes, it's completely voluntary. And that's really for the psychiatric part as well as the addiction part. But usually there's a driving factor. So yes, it's voluntary, but usually there's a driving factor. There has to be some sort of motivating factor. And so it's, you know, they're run into legal issues. And when we're talking about the addiction population, the substance use population, whether there's a legal issue or a professional issue, a family life crisis or situation, a health issue that's really sort of promoting them and pushing them to say, look, you might want to look into this, you know, and get some help and get some support because you're losing your career over it. You're losing your family over it. You've had multiple arrests. It's destroying your finances. It's destroying your well-being and your health overall. So usually those factors, even if it's not on their mind to say, okay, I need to get help, usually there's outside influences that will help motivate the person to sort of, you know, step into my office.
And that's a key part of it, right? Is that they are motivated. You're not dragging them along. They're there because they want to get help.
Yeah. Yeah. And oftentimes, you know, they're not motivated, but if they have enough reason to even just be open to that one, you know, visit and that consultation, it is my job to help the person get motivated. You know, I mean, there is a therapeutic modality called motivational interviewing that we're trained to use to kind of meet the person where they are. And at that point, they may not even see their use as a problem. They may not have any desire to stop. It's not my job to give up on the patient. You know, a lot of times everyone's given up on them, whether it's family, bosses, colleagues, friends, you know, everyone's given up on them. So it's my role to kind of be that little piece of hope and kind of just work with them where they are and help them understand maybe the benefits of possibly reducing or stopping, you know, their use and how their life can actually, you know, shift and become much better and have a better quality of life. So part of my job is to just really get them motivated, even if they're not there yet, and to just keep them engaged, you know, and if I can keep them coming to appointments, even if they're not, you know, ready to stop, if I can keep them engaged in coming into sessions, that in itself has been shown to be effective, you know, over time.
And that first meeting is really like the linchpin, right? Or one of the key touch points.
Yeah, I mean, it is, you know, this is a population that's been labeled as dishonest and manipulative and, you know, unwilling and difficult. And so they're walking in expecting me to kind of view them through that same lens. And so I need to sort of put all of my sort of biases and everything aside and understand that this person's here because really they need help. And if they don't see that they need help, that's okay. But it's my role to just, one, really in that first session, just to get them to trust me. You know, can they just open up to me? Can they share whatever they would like to share with me? And then it's my role to kind of gauge where they are as far as their awareness or willingness and motivation in regards to their addiction, and see how can I sort of create a little bit of a challenge within them and to help them see maybe it would be beneficial to look at, you know, stopping or slowing down and what that would look like for them. But yeah, that first session where you build rapport and get them to trust you is a very much a key session.
Yeah, and I can't help but to sort of make parallels to Stand Up For Kids work then in that same vein. So kind of the exact situation you laid out is what we deal with when we're finding youth on the street who have this certain life experience, and they have these adults that have not always treated them properly, and there's a lack of trust. And so coming in and breaking down those barriers and getting them to open up, and there's motivational components too, and like you said, just getting them to keep coming and showing up is one of the big steps. So I guess that's a good transition into your connection to Stand Up For Kids. So why don't you just tell me, like, how'd you find Stand Up For Kids, and what motivated you to get on board?
Yeah, I mean, they kind of found me, and I'm glad they did. You know, when I was completing my training in Los Angeles, I transitioned to Orange County and joined up with a colleague, sort of mentor of mine, and joined up in private practice with her here in Orange County. And she had already been sort of working with some of the youth in a clinical capacity. And so we sort of were working with a lot of the youth who were struggling either with psychiatric issues or substance use issues. So helping them with, you know, medications if needed, helping them to engage in treatment and get stable. A lot of them had dealt with trauma or ongoing substance use disorder. So my work, I would say in about 2011, started in sort of a clinical capacity, you know, where I was working with a few of these youth and sort of helping them to either get sober or manage depression, anxiety, or PTSD. And then I started, you know, communicating with Justine a lot more. And at that point, we were sort of wanting to grow the board. So the advisory board was really kind of starting up at that point. And then in 2012, I joined the advisory board at that point. And I would say since then, I mean, we've just grown tremendously. And so my role was still sort of in a clinical capacity by helping some of the youth, you know, as their psychiatrist or their addiction psychiatrist, but then really stepping into my role as an advisory board member with the chapter to see, you know, where do we want to go from here? You know, how do we want to grow? How do we want to make a really large impact on being able to outreach a lot of the youth, fundraise, provide support, provide services, get them connected to mentors? And then our advisory board just kind of grew from there in 2012 till about 2015 when I took on the role as the advisory board chair. And I held that position for about 4 years in sort of a leadership capacity, really alongside Justine. I mean, she really drives the organization and the chapter, but really kind of helping her and to see, you know, how can we continue to bring on board members and, you know, bring on more volunteers and fundraise. And then from there, you know, we've had multiple galas, virtual, some in person, and I've kind of helped with that in some capacity as well. So I've stepped back from the clinical capacity Standard for Kids since I'm no longer in private practice, but definitely, you know, involved still as an advisory board member and, you know, just have seen a tremendous amount of growth, you know, and success, I would say, in the past now 8-9 years or so that I've been involved.
That's great. That's awesome. So you came on as kind of like a consultant, I don't know if consultant's the right word, but so we're a trusted partner, I guess you could say, because we don't have psychiatrists on staff or licensed clinical social workers. So we rely on the Dr. Kumars of the world to help us in those situations. Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it was tough because, you know, a lot of our youth really needed treatment, you know, in some degree. So oftentimes, even if I wasn't working with them directly, maybe you would assist, you know, Justine or some of the other mentors in helping them get placed, you know, whether it's in a sober living program or a rehab program, you know, trying to get a scholarship or sponsor some of the youth, you know, into treatment. So it was kind of being, yeah, sort of a consultant and kind of being somebody in the front lines in a clinical capacity to kind of help navigate some of the clinical care. And then over the years, I've been held a training for some of our volunteers to kind of help understand how to work with some of our youth, sort of in that motivational capacity like we were speaking with before, because we can often feel stuck, you know, when working with somebody who has trauma and they're not trusting or substance use and they're perceived as manipulative. We ourselves start to kind of feel like we don't want to, you know, work with this population. And so we need to figure out, well, that's something that we need to overcome, you know, and how can we overcome that? And it does come down to really meeting the person where they are and just giving them time to trust you and let them understand that you're not just going to walk out on them just because they didn't follow your advice or your recommendations. You're not going to give up on them. And you can sort of empathize, you know, you can appreciate that they've had challenges. So I've kind of educated some of the volunteers and staff on this modality and kind of how to work with them and help them understand that it's not something that they're unwilling. It's just going to take some time, you know, but if you can be that sort of one person that's stable for them and consistent, then, you know, they'll start to come around and trust you and hopefully, you know, start to make better choices and, you know, see a change in their life.
Yeah, the field you're in is a challenging one.
Yes.
There's a lot of not wins. There's a lot of days that things don't go the right way necessarily. How do you deal with that personally?
I mean, unfortunately, you know, the relapse rate is much higher than the remission rate. There's no cure, you know, for psychiatric disorders. There's no cure for substance use or addiction, you know, diseases. But we have a lot of data, we have a lot of science, we have a lot of treatment options, we have a lot of medications, a lot of other treatment modalities. So, you know, I get asked this question quite a bit, you know, from patients' families, from friends, from colleagues, from other physicians who are non-psychiatrists and non-addiction medicine physicians. And, you know, I think my response has always kind of been the same, which is I really view myself as a resource, you know, and I tell patients that look, I'm here and I have the ability to really help you if you allow me to. You know, you have to take advantage of the resources that I can offer you and the knowledge that I have and the medications I can offer or the referrals I can place for you for therapy or rehab or support groups. But if you don't take advantage of what I have to offer, and that means putting in the time, coming into the sessions, making most of our time in session, following through with recommendations, then I have to understand that my role is limited. You know, so if a person doesn't follow my recommendations and, you know, there is continued relapse, I'm going to stay engaged with them, you know, and I'm going to let them know that I'm going to continue to be here to work with them and help them and support them, but to really let them know that I can't work harder than you. And so if you are willing to put the work in, I will be right there alongside with you to work just as hard as you. Sure. At times, do I need to work harder? Absolutely. But if that's the ongoing process, there isn't going to be a success. That person needs to be equally invested in their well-being, their future, their care, just as much as I am. So I think that's what I tell everyone is I look at myself as just a resource, and I want patients to take full advantage of what I can offer them. But if they don't, I have to understand that either they're not ready, you know, they don't want it yet. And that's sort of a choice they've made, but hopefully they'll stay engaged where I can help them to make that better choice for themselves. So I think that's kind of what gives me sort of peace of mind, I guess, at the end of the day, just knowing every person I talk to, every person I meet with, every family member, everyone that, you know, I'm trying to help, that I'm giving it my 100%. And if I know I've done that at every single session, every single day, then I feel like I can go home at the end of the day saying, well, I've given that person every opportunity to be healthier and happier, and now it's up to them.
That makes sense. Do you ever, so you deal with a lot of patients on every day, you're getting into the intimate details of their life and a lot of negative things, hopefully some positive things too. Do you ever, I guess where I'm trying to go is like taking things home. Are you able to like dissociate or segregate your professional life from everything else?
Yeah, I definitely have been, you know, and I've been told that by friends, family members, my wife, that, you know, you really don't bring work home, you know, and, you know, I can share just that, oh, I've had difficult experiences, or I've heard difficult situations, or, you know, there wasn't a great outcome, you know, and I can share that as sort of just a processing of my day, but I don't come home, I think, with sort of that emotional heaviness or toll, and I'm able to disconnect in a healthy way from work and, you know, engage in a healthy way with my family or friends or my own self-care. And I think it goes back to kind of what I said earlier is if knowing I got up that day, went to work, and I gave every single person my 100%, then I can sort of, you know, be at peace with that and learn to know that, okay, well, there may be things that are going to weigh on me at the end of the day. Like, I wonder if that person's going to follow up. I wonder if they're actually going to take the medication. I wonder if they're actually going to check into detox or rehab like I recommended. So sure, I'll think about that, you know, because I care, you know, and I may follow up the next day with them or their family member or review their chart to see, well, what happened? But is it something I'll sort of, you know, carry with me? No, because I know that I've said everything, I've offered everything I could, I did everything I could, that ultimately it's up to them. And I can, you know, and I'll make myself available to them if they decided to make a different decision to hopefully get them to re-engage in treatment and move forward with those recommendations that I make. But yeah, I think because of that, I'm able to sort of separate, and the work-life balance is a challenge, you know, for any professional, you know, in any specialty, even outside of medicine, and even within all specialties within medicine. And I value, you know, my time with family, and I see how precious life is, you know, and I see how much people go through, that it also makes me appreciate, you know, everything that I have, you know, in my own life and my own health. And so I really want to sort of, you know, take full advantage of that when I'm not at work. And so I can be there and be present for my wife and my kids and my family and friends. So I think that's how I'm able to kind of really separate, which is, it's not easy, but I think it's just a constant reminder. And if I'm able to do that at the end of the day, then I can come home.
Yeah, I think anybody that cares about what they do, that's always going to be a thing to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So I guess along those lines, do you have a routine, or do you have a thing that you do in regards to mental health or dissociation from work and home? Do you have any sort of thing that you do?
Yeah, you know, I mean, whether it's some sort of physical activity, you know, whether it's biking or hiking, running or working out, you know, that's always been something nice that I've sort of tried to introduce, you know, into my daily practice, as well as then, you know, maybe incorporating some meditation and some yoga. And, you know, as, you know, being a father now with two young ones, a lot of your time is sort of taken up by them, but that becomes part of your own self-care plan too, you know, and looking forward to activities with them, walks with them, hiking with them, bike riding. And then with my youngest one, I just had another child. So now my eldest one started doing yoga, you know, with her. And so incorporating yoga, there's of course so many platforms and apps and everything out there, but there's one that incorporates a lot of, you know, stories from either Disney stories or other stories or famous sort of fairy tales and books. And so you do yoga, you know, as the story is being narrated. And that becomes part of my own self-care, but also a way for me to be with, you know, family, and also then get them into the habit and practice of really focusing on breathing and stretching and disconnecting from the chaos of the world, you know, electronics, stress, and really focusing on just ourselves or that time with each other. So I would say that's become, you know, part of routine, is just spending time with family, some sort of exercise. You know, we're fortunate, we're in Southern California. I mean, getting outside to some degree is important. Going for a walk, getting some sunshine, getting to the beach or the park, you know, that becomes really, really important. And so just daily, I think self-care is important. And I find myself practicing that, and also just telling every patient about it. It doesn't matter if I'm working with you on just ADHD or bipolar disorder or a substance use disorder. If you don't have a daily routine of just basic self-care, you're not gonna function fully, you know, to your best ability, either in a mental health capacity or even a physical capacity. And when I mean daily routine, I mean basic things as far as just a regular sleep routine, you know, getting adequate sleep and a regular routine as far as, you know, a sleep schedule, going to bed around the same time, waking up around the same time, eating regularly, eating healthy meals, staying hydrated with water, you know, again, exercise, activity, sunlight. If those basic things are not met, and of course, not introducing unhealthy things into your system or body, whether that's from nutrition or substances, I think if you do just those basics, that foundation needs to be there in order to then further address either other issues that are happening or challenges you're facing, but it allows you to be better equipped in a physical capacity and also in a mental sort of clarity and mental capacity to take on challenges that life's going to throw at you, whether it's professionally or even personally. So I've kind of adopted that philosophy, you know, for myself and kind of for my family as well.
Do you formalize any of that? Do you have checks and balances that, oh, I didn't drink enough water today, or, oh, I go to bed too late, or is it just...
You know, it's kind of a, I don't, me personally, you know, I would say I don't like to kind of have it like, oh, I must get, you know, my 32 ounces of water. I must get my 8 hours of sleep. It's a gauge, you know, where you know sort of how much water you're drinking, how many times you fill up your water bottle. You know, you kind of know around what time you're going to bed, what time you're waking up, and you check in with yourself. You know, you can start to feel it like, oh, maybe I didn't get enough sleep last night, or maybe I didn't drink enough water, or I kind of ate unhealthy and I'm kind of feeling that now, or I didn't get enough exercise. So you have to listen to those cues. You know, your body is letting you know. And your body and your mind, they let you know either through irritability, I didn't get enough sleep, or fatigue, you know, I didn't eat well, I didn't drink enough water, I didn't get enough exercise. So once it becomes too strict, and again, this is just for myself personally, I find that then it can become an added stress of like, oh, well, then I didn't meet my goal. And then now it's something for me to sort of feel bad about. So if I didn't get the 8 hours, or I went to bed an hour later, or 2 hours later, or I didn't drink enough water, I don't want that to be something that I view myself as sort of like, oh, it was a failed goal. So I would say that it has to be sort of some flexibility, and has to be done with ease and not stress. And then I check in with myself, and I'll know if some of those parameters were sort of not met for that day or those, you know, previous days.
Yeah. And it, like you alluded to, it's a spectrum. Yeah. Some people are really on the ball with all those things and they're on a schedule and it just happens. And uh-huh. Then other people are completely the opposite and they're all over the place. And I mean, I've like myself, I'm a human. So I go through that as well. I have mood swings, and you try to listen to your body to, like you said, but it's not always that easy either, or at least sure. For me. So I guess I'm kind of off the rails from a self-care standpoint. Is there like a starting point for, all right, I want to kind of readjust where I'm at? Any suggestions for somebody in that position?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, There's a lot of starting points. You kind of want to look at, well, what's happening right now, you know, and you need to make adjustments from there. So if you're sleeping 12 hours a day or 12 hours in a 24-hour period, and it's not working for you, make an adjustment, you know, scale back, you know, and the opposite could be true. If you're not getting enough sleep, that's obviously not working for you. So make an adjustment. Maybe you're overeating, or you're eating unhealthy foods. So, you know, making changes there. I always, again, go back to the basics of just sleep hygiene, nutrition, you know, water intake, you know, exercise and sunlight, and removing any sort of unhealthy substance or quantity of an unhealthy substance or behavior, to really kind of find that balance. And again, that builds a foundation. So I tell all my patients, if, you know, I can prescribe a medication, you can go to therapy. But if you are, for example, using caffeine, you know, till 11 o'clock at night, you're coming to me with a concern of insomnia, we need to sort of address that issue rather than just medicate the insomnia that's created from the caffeine. So it's looking at all these factors. So it really comes down to, yes, sleep, you know, hydration with water, nutrition, exercise, sunlight. And then there's the psychological part, the mental health part, which is learning to kind of really live in the moment. We really can't undo the past. We really can't control the future. We can have plans, you know, we can anticipate, we can dream, we should have goals, but life's unpredictable. You know, at the end of the day, tomorrow, 6 months from now, years from now, we don't know, but we all are guilty of this, where we find ourselves either ruminating about the past or anticipating or worrying about the future. And then our moments of the day get away from us. And so I always tell people, slow down. Life is already moving very, very quickly for all of us. So be in the moment. And, you know, and that's where mindfulness can come in, is just learning to sort of be grounded and appreciate the simple things of just the sounds you're hearing, the things you're smelling, you know, things you're tasting, the feelings you're having in that moment, because that moment's going to be gone. You know, it's now going to become part of the past. So you really learning to kind of stay in the moment and managing what's in front of you right then and there, and not worrying about the things you can't necessarily undo from the past or things that you can't necessarily change or control from the future. So if you learn to just do that, it actually brings a sense of peace, because you're now owning, you know, that moment of your life, and you're now present for it. And that's powerful for you as a person, but I think that's powerful also for just others around you and allowing them to really stay grounded and kind of in that moment for you. So I would say that's where I tell everyone to start, is just basic self-care and the mindset of kind of being more present and kind of sort of learning to live in the moment.
I like both of those areas that you mentioned. I want to briefly go into both of them. So the first one, which is basic self-care, I think the struggle, and I've personally had the struggle of like knowing what is the right thing to do and then doing the right thing. So I should go to bed because I know that tomorrow is a big day or whatever, but this Netflix show's on or this phone is just driving me nuts or whatever. I'm really engaged in this cat video or whatever. So it's discipline. And I, you know, it's like food too. Like, you know, I know I'm not supposed to eat that candy bar, but it's a delicious candy bar and I really want it. So I have my short-term needs and my long-term needs. And so I'm sabotaging my long-term self for this short-term gratification.
Sure.
So you could tell me, hey, don't eat that candy bar all day long, but I really want to eat that candy bar. And I don't always have the self-control to not eat the candy bar.
Sure. Sure. And look, we're all human and we all deserve some short-term gratification, you know, in a healthy way. And so I always put that qualifier in, you know, especially when dealing with people with a substance use disorder. That doesn't mean you can go on a binge with a substance once in a while because of that short-term gratification. So the short-term gratification always has to be, you know, within reason and something that's conducive for your well-being and your health mentally and physically. So look, if you want to have a candy bar, great, you know, earn it, you deserve it, enjoy it. But again, it has to be something that sort of becomes a treat and, but not sort of daily if that excess sugar is affecting your diabetes or it's affecting your mood. And it's, you know, depleting or taking the space of other healthy nutrients, then it's really not a treat. It's become an unhealthy way to cope. So you really want to kind of look at like, why am I reaching for that? You know, and I'm reaching for that because I am doing well and I am feeling good physically and mentally. And I'm really doing it because I really want to enjoy that snack or that candy bar. And same thing, you know, especially with this past year in the pandemic, you know, everyone's schedule and routines have sort of had to be reevaluated and readjusted because now so many people are working from home, or what a colleague of mine said is, we're actually not working from home, we brought our home to work. So now we're getting up 5 minutes, 10 minutes before our first Zoom call or meeting, where before we had a routine, you know, getting up and getting ready and showering and having breakfast and then drive to the office, listening to podcasts, listening to music, listening to sports radio. But all of that is therapeutic. You know, it sets the tone for the day. And the same thing with the drive back home. It becomes our time to make phone calls to family and friends, listen to music, decompress, de-stress. But you lose that, you know, and we've lost a lot of that because now we're staying up later because I don't have to commute and I literally have to go from my bed to the desk, you know, to start my work. But that becomes disruptive, you know, because you lose. It becomes chaotic, you know, it becomes, you know, you become sleep deprived, which has an effect on not just your emotional health, but also your cognitive health. So you're more, you know, distracted, you're less productive, you're less focused. And then you lose that personal time, you know, from waking up to starting work and then from stopping work to, you know, returning home. And so I tell people, you have to pretend it's the same thing that you're commuting. You get up when you do. You start your day, you make your morning coffee or have your breakfast, and you listen to your music. You listen to your podcast. You listen to your sports talk radio before you start work. And, you know, that's important for you as far as your routine and kind of your self-care. So again, I think going back to realizing what did work for you before. And if you were unsure what worked for you before, make changes to all of those areas. And whether it's, you know, quantity of sleep or sleep routine, or whether it's water intake, whether it's types of foods or sugar, quantities of sugar, you know, alcohol, caffeine, you know, consumption, substance use consumption, and then exercise and self-care too, you know, checking in with family has been, or friends has been challenging because of the pandemic, but having to, you know, to get creative through video calls, Zoom calls, and just telephone calls, or safely meeting up, you know, through masks and social distancing. But all of that is still important. It's just now it needs to become more of a priority, and a lot more effort needs to be put in to kind of make those things happen, but it's just as valuable. And so I tell people, those are all the areas that you need to sort of kind of really look at and modify and keep some consistency and routine, even if you are working from home.
All good stuff. And then the second point you made was just about being in the moment. And not looking at the past and not looking at the future. Every time I hear that, I'm like, oh yes, that is perfect. That's exactly right. And then an hour goes by and I'm like, so I think the constant reminder, having a mechanism that centers you, which is it that routine in the morning? Is it meditation midday? But something that kind of pulls you back to the now.
Yeah.
Each person kind of needs to find what that is for them.
Absolutely. You know, and it's meditation, I think it can be practiced in numerous different ways. It's not necessarily through breathing or through breath exercises or through use of an app or yoga. I mean, meditation really is about kind of just taking a pause and staying in that moment. And if for someone that means their meditation is sort of kind of like, you know, taking a walk or just sitting in a chair in their backyard, but really just kind of learning to just stay in that moment. And then naturally, I think what happens is maybe you do become aware of your breath, or you do become aware of the birds chirping or the sun, or, you know, if you become aware of just your environment, you know, your feet on the ground, you know, the warmth of the coffee you're having or something, that is what meditation is. You know, it's difficult for a lot of people. And for me, myself, it was something that I had to practice, you know, because it is very challenging to not have your mind wander. But that is part of meditation, is that your mind does wander, but it's sort of the active participation and skill of bringing it back and saying, yes, I know I have this deadline at work, I know I have this challenging patient, and I know I have this family member who's struggling. I can be aware of those thoughts, and I can be aware of those feelings and emotions associated with those thoughts, but I'm going to bring it back to me right now, and this moment, and what I can do for myself. Because if we want to help others, whether it's in a personal or professional capacity, we have to be in the right state of mind, and we have to be centered and balanced. But it's going to be something that requires effort. You know, it's not just going to happen on its own, just like everything else in life, whether it's, you know, facing a disease like diabetes or high blood pressure or psychiatric issues or addiction. It's something you need to have a daily effort in. And so that's why I tell everyone, whether it's just 5 minutes of breathing, for some people it works to have a meditation, you know, exercise at the start of their day. For others, it's the end of the day. For others, the middle of the day. Whatever that meditation looks like for you, practice it. And if that means just closing your eyes while you're at your desk and closing your eyes and just not looking at the screen and just taking 5 or 10 breaths, that is powerful. You know, it does recenter you, and it's very therapeutic in the moment, and also just beneficial, I think, for sort of the long run.
All right, so we're getting close to the end. So I wanna close it out with a final question for you. So we talked about mental health and mental illness, and kind of your expertise in it and ways to cope. If you could leave our audience with one takeaway in dealing with people with mental health issues, what would you say?
You know, I think the biggest takeaway, you know, that I've sort of learned, I think over the years, kind of in a professional capacity, even in a personal capacity, by helping, you know, friends or friends of friends or family members or friends, family members, is just that we're all struggling. Every one of us. The struggle may appear different. It may look different. It may not warrant medications. It may not warrant therapy. It may not warrant rehabilitation from drugs or alcohol, but we all have a struggle that we're dealing with. So what I tell everyone is check in, you know, check in with yourself, but check in with everyone around you, because they may appear to be doing really well. They may appear to have life going great for them. And that may be the case, but there's still a struggle. And I think everyone can always appreciate just a brief check-in from somebody. Just, hey, how are you? You know, how's this day been? How's this week been? How's this past year been for you? You know, I think we can all appreciate it, because that goes a long way, because we really don't know what sort of life that person's lived. We don't know what sort of day they've had. We don't know what sort of news that's been delivered to them, what sort of tragedy that sort of either happened or on the horizon for them. So I think I tell everyone is just keep in mind that not everyone who's medicated or in therapy are the ones dealing with a struggle. We all are. And it looks very different, but we all really could use a check-in with each other and could really benefit from that.
Well said. Totally agree. Okay. All right. We're going to wrap up, but really appreciate you coming on and being part of Stand Up for Kids.
Absolutely. Anytime, Mike. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Kumar.
All righty.
Thank you for listening today to Listen Up, the Stand Up for Kids podcast. A big thank you to Gabby Villarreal and Billy Wynn for their production and editing support. Find us on YouTube, Spotify, Google Play, iTunes, and wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to support Stand Up for Kids, please share this podcast with family, friends, and colleagues. Also, check out our website at standupforkids.org/Orange County, and you can email me directly at michaelo@standupforkids.org to learn more. Please also consider a donation to help getting kids off the streets. 92 cents out of every dollar donated goes directly to supporting these kids. I'm your host, Michael Olson, Director of Development at Stand Up for Kids, Orange County. Thanks for listening and have a great day.